Dinner this evening was real interesting. After dinner, and we started this raffle thing, I was really surprised that Dick didn't win that encyclopedia. it was most appropriate. He sat down next to me. We were going to start visiting, and she gave him a look. Immediately, without hesitation, he sprung to life, moved over, measured 6.5 inches to the left of her chair, exactly where he belonged. Yeah. Never blinked an eye. And I thought, boy, if he followed these steps that close, he could walk on water. Before I get started here, there's a little housekeeping I need to take care of. One is, I want to thank whoever is responsible for asking me to come and share tonight. And the reason I want to thank them is because I found out that whenever the Hand of Alcoholics Anonymous asked me to do something, if it's possible for me and I can find a way to say yes, because Alcoholics Anonymous was there when I reached out. The Hand of AA was there, so when the Hand of AA asked me to do something, if I can do it, it might be possible for me to go another day without taking a drink. And that anybody that gives me an opportunity to say yes and to go another day without taking a drink, I should thank them for that. And for that, I thank you for giving me another chance to go another day without taking a drink. For those of you who are new, and I know there's a few new ones in here, if no one has well or relatively new and young in sobriety, if no one has ever welcomed you to Alcoholics Anonymous, let me welcome you to the greatest gift God has ever given his children besides life itself. This is the greatest thing on earth. It is a way of life beyond your wildest imagination. And if you're not having fun yet in Alcoholics Anonymous, get into Alcoholics Anonymous. Get busy. Alcoholics Anonymous has rocketed me into a fourth dimension of living in which had never even dreamt. And it'll do the same for you. And I want to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous in a way of life beyond your wildest imagination. And don't let all these gray hairs and all this sobriety intimidate you. Let me tell you, when I first got sober, my sponsor had 13 years of sobriety, and I thought, you old fool, you've been sober so long, you don't even know what it's like to be drunk. Every person in this room that has a sobriety date had a first meeting, first day of sobriety. You don't get 41 years of sobriety without having day one. You've got to have day one. And so everyone here has been exactly where you are if you're new in sobriety. And just hang on. Don't quit before the miracle. I am Robert Barris, and I'm a real alcoholic. And that's the one the book talks about, and that's important for me. Because when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was not an alcoholic. I came to your meetings, heard your stories, and the places you'd been, the things you'd done, and I wasn't like that. See, I hadn't been in those places, and I hadn't done those things. And tonight, truly by the grace of God, I can say I stayed around here just long enough to look at me a little bit and determine that if I kept on drinking, I might become alcoholic. I might be a little bit alcoholic or kind of alcoholic. Even if I was alcoholic, I was a better class alcoholic than you. Yeah. Yeah, I can stand up here tonight and read. I introduce myself as a real alcoholic. And I can stand up here tonight and read pages, read the first definition of a real alcoholic on page 2122 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know everything there is to know about me, because my whole story is on those two pages. But that's not what I'm here to do tonight. I'm here to share me with you. I just love here in chapter 5 read, it says, our adventures before and after. Now, I had a lot of things before I sobered up, but I never, ever would have used the word adventure. I've had some things happen recently I wouldn't necessarily describe as adventure either, but see, y'all almost missed it with me. You told me to read the book. I found out something. I found out if you want to hide something from a drunk, put it in a book. He'll never find it. You know, and that's where I found the first description of a real alcoholic. In chapter 5, it says that we share in a general way what we were like and what happened and what we're like today. Now, my drunk log has to be kind of general because I'm a blackout drinker. I wasn't there. Everything I get is secondhand information, you know. The reports are still coming in. So I don't know. And oh, man, what I was like. My earliest recollection, I'm 4.5 years of age, thereabouts, and we're living on a farm. And I'm out there playing in the irrigation ditch, doing whatever those little boys do in irrigation ditches, you know. And I look up, and there's a big tom turkey coming over the corral fence. And well, something you need to know about me is I hear things and see things differently than a lot of people. I hear things and see things that aren't there. And I hear things that haven't been said. And just because you tell me so-and-so, that doesn't necessarily mean that's what I hear. I think we worry a lot about what the newcomer hears in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll get into that a little bit later. Just because you tell me these walls are white or some shade thereof doesn't necessarily mean that's what I see. Because the way I hear things and the way I see things, that tom turkey came over that corral fence and got me down on the ground and flogged me real good. And I'm out there bawling, squalling, carrying on. My mama came out with a broom or a mop or whatever it was she had in her hand. She ran that turkey off and jerked me up, and she said, "Dry your eyes and be a big boy. Men don't cry." That's what she said. What I heard her say was, "You're crying, therefore you're not a big boy." And that explained it. That explained to me why I never felt like a big boy and I never felt like a man. I dried my eyes and I never shed another tear until I walked in the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, because men don't cry. I almost died trying to be Clint Eastwood. You know, it just, because men don't cry. Some of the other things I heard about in those days, I heard about God. And I heard God answers prayers. Just pray and God will answer your prayer. I don't know how old I was. I was yay so old. And y'all going to find out I don't know anything about kids. And I'm praying for a red bicycle for Christmas. Boy, and I've just prayed my little heart out. I ain't seen that red bicycle till yet. I didn't know God sometimes says no. Today, when I ask for specifics like that, God doesn't just say no. He says, "You got to be kidding." Yeah. I heard other things about God. I heard that if you do so-and-so, God's going to get you for that. And if you think it, you just as well have done it. Well, I don't know about you, but I think a lot. I still think a lot. You hear somebody after one of these things saying they don't, watch them, because they'll lie to you about something else too. You know, today the difference is I have exactly the same thoughts today I've always had. The difference is I don't have to take action on them today, and I never had a choice before. I never had a choice. If I thought it was a done deal, if I thought I'd get away with it, I heard things like, "God loves you, and you'll burn in hell forever." Yeah. My little prayer, "Now lay me down to sleep, if I should die before I wake." Boy, that cost me a lot of sleepless nights, y'all. Because God loved me, don't you know? And I heard about sex. And it's dirty and it's nasty and it's filthy, and you save it for the one you love. I'm like this and I hadn't had a drink of alcohol yet, y'all. I'm a time bomb waiting to go off. I was raised out in Oklahoma, out in the flatlands, you know, and alcohol was no big deal in my early years. This is interesting to me because it's my story, but I remember my first drink of alcohol. And my first drink of alcohol, kids to me are not in ages, they're in heights. You know, I don't get it, but I'm yay so high, however old you are when you're yay so high. And my step-grandfather gave me a little cheese glass of cold Budweiser beer, and it was just no big deal. You know, it was cold, it was good. I remember the conversation. I remember everybody was there, everything that was going on. I drank that thing, went on to bed. I did not go out that night and steal a car, wreck it, have an affair with the neighbor's wife, and wind up in jail that time. What's interesting to me about it is that I love Coca-Cola, absolutely love Coca-Cola, almost go to bed with Coca-Cola. I do not remember my first Coca-Cola. I don't think that necessarily makes me alcoholic. It's just kind of interesting to me. I remember my first drink, or at least what I call my first drink up and through today. A lot of time, boy, I ain't kidding when they say more will be revealed to you. It is still being revealed to me. But my first drink occurred when I was 15, 16 years old. And I was raised out in Oklahoma, out in the flatlands. And everything out there is 1 mile by 1 mile, laid out in section lines. And we used to do a deal we call Run the Wolves. Let me tell you how sick I was when I got here and how bad I wanted to be macho. I was 5 years sober, and happy it hit me when I was talking at the Catholic Church in North Little Rock at that Sunday speaker meeting deal. It hit me like a ton of bricks. We were not running wolves. We were running coyotes. But it's hard to be a macho man and run Wile E. Coyote. You know, there's something wolf. You know, God, that's you know, macho. But we'd throw those dogs in the back of those pickup trucks and we'd go by the bootlegger. Oklahoma at that time, hunting time was dry. And we'd go by the bootlegger and pick up a bottle of 10 High whiskey and drive those section lines and drink that whiskey until somebody spot one of those things and jerk the tailgate on that truck and listen to those dogs run all night. It's a good reason for a kid to be out all night. This particular night I came in, it was about 5 o'clock in the morning, and I came in after having been out running the wolves all night. And I came out of a blackout, and I'm standing in front of my father after having just put his car through the back of his garage. And I'm standing there in that paisley black and white cowboy shirt and those black and white cowboy boots and my underwear. That's normal social drinking for me, y'all. Now, if it's placed in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it really scares me to death, is where it says, paraphrase it, deep down inside every man and woman is desire to return to normal social drinking. Ain't I got a lot to look forward to? Yeah, because that's the best it ever got. I went on through school, and drinking was no big deal, because, I mean, I guess even bootleggers had ethics, and they'd only sell so much to a kid on a bicycle. And, well, I was doing the best I could. You know, I was working with whatever it is I had to work with. And I know none of y'all, I can tell by looking at you, that none of y'all ever started having these problems, but I started having problems with authority figures. You know, they were wanting me to do things I didn't want to do. And they were wanting me to stop doing some of the things I was doing or getting ready to do. And it seemed like we were just on collision course all the time. And I got finally I got out of high school. Yeah, I don't know who's happier to see me go, me or them. But I got out of high school, and I went to school. I went on into college. And I did not know why I went to college when I went to college. See, I'm the kind of guy, I never get to know what it is I'm doing when I'm doing it. The only way I know today why it is I went to college the first time is through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, take an inventory and share it with another human being and find out the reason it got in another human being. And the only reason that I went to college the first time is out of fear. And I usually say there's some in here old enough. There's a lot of y'all in here old enough to remember when the draft was still in effect. And about that point in time, the draft was still in effect, and I had a little old bitty number from a little old bitty county, you know, and about that time, Kennedy and Castro couldn't get along, and the Bay of Pigs came up, and it looked like we was going to war, boy. I mean, it looked like for all the world we was going to war. And even I knew you could get hurt in a war. And I'm a sensitive person, and I hurt easily, and I don't suffer well. So how do you get out of war? You get a student deferment. You go to school. And so that's what I did. I got a student deferment and went to school. 3 semesters later, I had a 1.1 grade average. See, I didn't know they expected you to be there. I had places to go and people to see. I was busy, you know. But it's a funny thing about a drunk. Or at least this drunk. You know, it wasn't my grade point why they asked me to leave. I had that covered because, you know, we make a living selling fast talk to slow-thinking people. And I had that base covered. They asked me to leave because I'm an alcoholic. Because when I take a drink of alcohol, it sets off a physical craving in me, and I take a second drink of alcohol, and a second drink of alcohol takes a third, and a third and takes a fourth, and a fourth takes a fourth. Next thing you know, the alcohol takes a drunk. And I go into a blackout, and I do things I'd never do under any other circumstance. And this particular night, I took a drink of alcohol, and drink of alcohol took a drink. And then the drink of alcohol took a drink, and the drink took me drunk. And I took a 12-gauge shotgun and tried to kill the dorm mother. And because of a lot of extenuating circumstances, and truly by the grace of God, and through nothing on my part, they made me a deal I couldn't refuse. They said, if you leave Lawton, Oklahoma and never come back, we won't press charges. And I did and they didn't. That's how I make amends to Lawton, Oklahoma. You know, I haven't been back till yet. Every now and then I go to Oklahoma City, and one of the hotels that I'm subject to stay in is sitting just outside the H.E. Bailey Turnpike. And you look out there and see that sign going entering the H.E. Bailey Turnpike says Lawton, Oklahoma, 62 miles. And I know there's still roadblocks up. And that's been a long time ago. I left there and my life continued. And next thing I know, I'm coming out of another blackout because I'd taken a drink. And a drink took a drink. And the drink took a drink. And the drink took me drunk. And I'm coming out of this. I always drawed cops. Early in my drinking career, and you never hear normal drinkers refer to it as a career, but in my early drinking career, I always draw the cop, and they're not the ones you see today. The ones you see or look today, a lot of them are little short, blonde, petite things, you know. Mine were always in excess of 6'1" or 6'2", somewhere around 240, had attitude, looked like they may have played, you know, linebacker for the Chicago Bears or something. And this particular night, I'd taken a drink of alcohol and gone into a blackout. And when I came out of it, I'm standing inside of a salvage yard. And I've got one of these guys on each of my arms. And I had a starter to an Oldsmobile under my right arm. And I didn't own an Oldsmobile. I didn't know anybody who did own an Oldsmobile. And state of Oklahoma began to question my sanity. And I didn't have any answers. They were asking me questions I couldn't answer, or that they really didn't like the answer to. And so they sent me to Norman, Oklahoma. And Norman, Oklahoma was before that, is now, and I guess it'll always be the home of the state insane asylum. And in those days, they didn't separate the drunks from the nuts. And I know what it's like to be locked up in a 6-foot by 8-foot room with rubber walls and a rubber floor and a 1-inch thick paper mattress on the floor and paper pajamas and paper shoes. There's some things you have to give up when you come to Program of Alcoholics Anonymous. One of the things I've given up since coming to Program of Alcoholics Anonymous is I haven't found it necessary to wear paper shoes. I wear the leather. And I'm really just getting back into the leather after this last summer. But it's kind of a funny thing, though. You know, they kept me there, and we played their little games, and they talked about my mother, and I talked about their mother, and you know, my stay got extended, and but it's a funny thing. You give a drunk 3 hots and a cot, and he'll stand up and walk and talk just like anybody else. And I did not have a sign across me that said drunk. Yeah, and to the best of my knowledge, as I stand here tonight, no one ever asked me about my drinking. They never once asked me about my drinking. Wouldn't have mattered if they'd asked me. I'd have lied to them because I was going to drink, because drinking was important for me. Drinking was magic. Drinking took a nothing and a nobody who was unhappy and miserable and scared to death on the inside and took that and made it almost. And when you're nothing and nobody on the inside and scared to death and just terrified of life and want to be somewhere else with somebody else, nothing, hey, almost is top of the world, baby. It doesn't get any better than that. And so it wasn't a question of whether I was going to drink. I was going to drink. But if you're here tonight and you're new, see, drinking wasn't my problem. Drinking was my solution. Drinking allowed me to live out there long enough with them to be beaten to my knees to get to you all to find out what my problem is. And my problem is I don't know how to live life. I can't live life out there without some help. And alcohol was my help for a long time. If drinking is your problem, if that's your only problem, I got a deal for you. You don't have to get a sponsor. You don't have to buy a book. You don't have to go to any of these dippy meetings. Yeah, you don't have to write that fearful inventory. Just don't drink. Somebody's tried, Dad. I don't know about you, but there are some things worse than being drunk. One of them is being sober without a way to live. For me, for this age, if you're the kind of alcoholic I am, that's a tough road. Well, I left Norman, Oklahoma. They let me out of there, and I used to say I was free. I wasn't free. I was just loose. Yeah, and that was the last time, y'all, that alcohol was a problem for me. Up until the time I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I've lied already. I didn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous. They brought me. What did I last? 10 minutes without a lie. That is fantastic. But I was just loose, and I left there, and I had some principles set by that time. I love talking about principles in Alcoholics Anonymous today, but in those days the principles are a little different than they are today. One of the principles I'd set down was, if I set my mind to it, there ain't nothing I can't do. Well, I don't know where y'all drank, but in some of the places I drank, that will get you physically hurt. You know, right quick. I got out of there and I went back to school. And I started doing some things that was the last time I was in trouble. Because that's the last time the law was involved. As long as the law was not involved, it was not a problem to me. Period. You know, whatever it took, I was willing to give. That was the thing about alcohol for me. Alcohol was a remover. And there's some of y'all in here remember the commercials about Energene and the cleaning fluid, you know? And that's the way alcohol worked in my life. Alcohol knocked on the door and said, tonight, I want your self-respect. Okay. And alcohol knocked on the door next week and said, I want your job. Okay. Whatever it was. And alcohol knocked on the door and said, I want your wife. Okay. Alcohol knocked on the door and said, I want your belief in God. Okay. Whatever it was, I was ready to pay the price. And alcohol took all those things from me, one thing at a time. But I was a long way from there yet. And I was a long, long way from knowing that. And everything I say tonight is in retrospect. I did not know it when I was going through it at the time. In fact, because of my magic mind, I never get to know what it is I'm doing when I'm doing it. And a lot of times it'll look like I'm wherever it is I am, and I'm not there. I don't know where it is I go, but I go somewhere. And I can look around. I've seen already at least two of y'all that are here, but you ain't here. You know? And I understand, because I've done that this weekend already myself. But I started doing some things I found out of the cost of it. I started getting married. And I started getting divorced. The kind of way my life was then, I'd be wherever it was I was, doing whatever it was I was doing with whoever it was I was doing it with, and she'd walk in the door. And you guys know what she looked like. And I'd look at her and I'd think, boy, if I could just have her, everything would be all right. And I'd put on those clothes and I'd talk that talk and I'd walk that way. I'd get her. The next words out of my mouth would be, if I could just get rid of her, everything would be all right. Yeah. And I'd get rid of her and I'd get me another her, and then I'd forget about getting rid of this one before I got that one. And my life got busy. Yeah, I got here a tired old man and it's just worn out. I kept divorce lawyers in a lot of money for a long time. And drinking was no big deal because the law was not involved and everybody has to be somewhere. And I was in school and going through all this. And I finally graduated. If you stay in school long enough, they're finally going to force you to graduate, you know. But I showed them. I graduated and I didn't learn a whole lot. But I got a degree or two or three. And I graduated and moved to Little Rock, Arkansas. And the only reason I moved to Little Rock, Arkansas at that point in time was my father retired over there. And I'm going to have this good job and I'm going to be able to take a little time off. And he and I'll get to go fishing and drink a beer together and tell a couple of lies. And then I'll have those memories that I had, that all my friends have. I'll have those childhood memories. My dad worked 24/7 in the oil field when I was growing up. And I didn't get to spend a lot of time with him. And I didn't have those memories. If I could just have those memories, then everything would be all right. A couple of years after I moved over there, just when I reached that point in my life where I could take a little time off, he and I drank beer together and go fishing and tell a few lies and what have you. God let my daddy die. And I buried my father, and I never shed a tear publicly or privately, because a man doesn't cry. Nobody knew what I was feeling on the inside. And God had done that to me. I never once thought about my mother had lost her spouse of 30-some-odd years. I never once thought about the fact my dad had terminal heart disease the last 3 or 4 or 5 years of his life, and, you know, painful terminal heart disease. I never once thought about all the people whose lives he had touched, whose lives would never be the same again because he wasn't in them. God did that to me. By that time, I had what I call that 4-foot-thick concrete steel reinforced wall between me and you. Problem with that wall is... So I built that wall because if you ever found out about me, you might find out that I'm not living up to whatever it is I think you think I ought to be. And you might reject me. And so how do I handle rejection? I'll reject you first. But I lost me behind that wall. I looked up one day and I didn't know who I was or what I thought I was. You know, I was just one of those people. It's a lot like a lot like some of my ex-wives. And there are several of them. I numbered them. I don't try to keep up with names, you know. I can't imagine. I have to raise an eyebrow every time I see somebody come in the door by a false anonymous and has the same wife they've had for 30 years. Yeah, you've got to, you almost have, it seems like we ought to have in our rules somewhere that you have a couple of them. but my ex-wives, I just love them. They used to ask me questions like, "Where have you been?" I was a blackout drinker. I didn't know. Even if I did know, I knew I couldn't tell them. "And have you been drinking?" "Had two beers." Mm-hmm. And they made these unreasonable demands on me. They would expect me to go to the store for whatever it was I went to the store and come home that night with whatever it is that I went for. Tell you how it really was. My first ex-wife had a charge account with a locksmith. This was back in the early 60s, you know. I'd come home and it wasn't my door anymore. The lock had been changed. I knew how bad I'd been the first of every month when we got the bill. You know, how many times he'd been out. Yeah, anyway. I'd buried my father, and God looked down about this point in time. And he saw I wasn't going to get to where it was I was supposed to be, whenever it was I was supposed to be there. And I hate this today. I absolutely hate this today. But God allowed me to become responsible for my own actions. I don't want to be responsible for my action. I want to be his fault, her fault, their fault, you know, somebody's fault. Not mine. God did not do this to me. I'm going to get into fears a little later, but my whole life has been run on fear. And one of the fears, you know, that I have is a fear of height. I am terrified of height. I am absolutely panic-stricken with height. This is a little high right now, and y'all notice I'm standing back and hanging on. So where does a good practicing alcoholic go for vacation that's afraid of height? Tell you where this one went. This one went skiing. Snow skiing. And God did not do this to me. He may have set the stage, but he didn't do it. The day we got there, it got up into the 40s or so and melted the top 6 or 8 inches of that ice. The night after, that night, it got back down zero or so, and it refroze out in the solid ice. The night after it happened, it came another 8 inches of powdered snow, and if it had happened on powdered snow, it never would have happened. But it didn't. It happened in one window of time that entire year that there was ice on that mountain. And it's a little bit spooky because that mountain's not too awful far from here, just over the line in North Carolina. And somebody said about going to the Smoky National Park. I've been to the Smoky. I've seen the Smokies, and my experience there wasn't real good. But we got there, and next morning we got up, and went up to that ski lodge. And for those of you who have never been to a ski lodge, they're a lot like AA. They're a lot like some of my ex-wives asking those stupid questions. They asked some stupid questions in AA, too, but one of the questions they asked me was, "Do you need any instructions?" I can fly the space shuttle without instructions. I can build it if you give me just a little bit of time. Well, I got those skis and those boots, and let me tell y'all that if you haven't been there, that is not as easy to put on as much you might think they are. About 2 hours later, I finally figured out how to put those things on and stand up. Then I had to make some decisions. Now, my life has been one decision right after another. My sponsor and I talk about my decider a lot. I'm the kind of guy that I can see a deal coming down the pipe, and I know there's going to be 10 seconds of instantaneous gratification and 2 weeks of living hell to pay, and it'll look like a good deal to me. And I'll take it every time. You know, I'd just do that. Well, I had to make a decision that morning which lift to get on. And the first one over here was the beginner's lift, and it just went a little way up that slope. And the next one was the intermediate lift, and it went kind of up that mountain. And the next one was the advanced. And the next one was the expert. Guess which one I got on? They called it the Land of Oz. Boy, howdy, I agree, it was. Another story of my life is I almost made it. I did, y'all. I didn't like but 50 feet making it. That's embarrassing to say that out loud now. 50 feet and I'd have made it. I'd have been home free, but I didn't. And I took a fall on that ice and I fractured my leg and my hip in such a way they had to hand carry me off that mountain. They put me up there in that hospital in that little old dippy town, about 400 people. You know, and I was on the top floor, second. You know, the closest phone was on the first. Tell you how this hospital operated. You know the call button thing in the hospital? I don't know how I've gotten off on this lately, but that hospital was so up to date, their call button was a string. And you'd pull the string and a flag would go up out in the hall, and the nurse would come down and ask you, "What do you want?" And that doctor came in there, you know, I'm laying there all busted up, and he had that radiograph in his hand. He threw that radiograph up on that viewer and looked at it, and he looked at me and looked back at that radiograph, and he said, "Son, you know you're in trouble when a doctor calls you son." Just a tip. He says, "Son, you're never going to walk again. And I'm 1,000 miles from home, and I'm going to be by myself. My friends are going to have to leave, and I'm by myself, and I'm scared to death, and I'm never going to be able to walk again. And how are you going to be a man if you can't even walk?" Absolutely stark, raving terror set in on me. You know, I can handle fear. Mine goes right on past fear into stark terror. And I laid up there for 8 days and 8 nights, and I never took a bite of food or a drink of water. Stark terror. And finally, on the 9th day, old self set in. I just love it when this happens. Old self set in. Self said, "Self, you got you into this, and you'll get you out of this." 6 days later, they released me. You know, and I wasn't walking, but they released me. He was right about that. I wasn't walking. And the doctor gave them to me. And I introduced myself as a real alcoholic. I'm not a pure alcoholic. And I was like, "Stop long here. Because I've been around a little while. I only mention this because of one question that comes up later in my story that's real important. But I'm glad I've been around long enough to know what AA is and what AA is not. I'm glad I know I've been around long enough to know what AA stands for. It stands for Alcoholics Anonymous. It does not stand for Alcoholic Anda. It stands for Alcoholics Anonymous and what we're about. It stands for Alcoholics Anonymous, the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and what was going on up there in that room. I don't know if any of y'all noticed that or not. I walked up there this evening for dinner, and that room is full of people, and everybody's just doing this business, you know, and it looks like there's a whole bunch of dialogue going on. Actually, there were about 60 monologues going on, but that's fellowship, you know, and being together. AA stands for Alcoholics Anonymous, the program, the 12 steps to recovery, the program by Alcoholics Anonymous. AA stands for Alcoholics Anonymous, the name of our book. The name of our book ought to be a clue as to what we're about. Book says we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful, period, end of sentence. And what I found out is if I take care of my alcoholism, everything else takes care of itself, period. No exceptions. Everything else takes care of itself if I take care of my alcoholism. I left there, you know, and I feel like I'm kind of preaching to the choir, but I can't ever get past that spot without without doing that, because there seems to be some confusion around about what Alcoholics Anonymous is and what Alcoholics Anonymous isn't. And I don't know about around where you're from, but we seem to be getting some BB meetings lately. I don't know what BB meetings are, but they're not AA meetings. And it kind of distresses. I hate doing this, because when I got sober, there's always some old fool, gray-haired fool, standing up talking like this. Now, what are you talking about? And here I am, an old gray-haired fool, standing up here talking like that. You know, be careful what you say. You're going to wind up doing it. But I'll get off that for right now. I left there, and the doctor had given them to me, and I was in a lot of physical pain. And I took the first three of those things according to directions. And it was, I don't know, an hour and a half drive to the airport, where I caught a flight into Atlanta, Georgia. And it was an hour and 15-minute flight into Atlanta, Georgia. And bless those stewardesses. I guess they're flight attendants today. They were stewardesses back then. And bless their hearts. They saw the shape I was in, and they started those Bloody Marys coming to me at 5 o'clock in the morning, just exactly the way I like them, one right after another. Hour and 15 minutes later, that plane touched down Atlanta, Georgia, and those Bloody Marys and those other little things all hit about the same time I had my first spiritual experience. You know, I could have gone to Little Rock without that plane. I just couldn't get takeoff clearance. I got back to Little Rock and had more surgery, and obviously I can walk tonight. We may get into that. I've had to have a lot of that surgery, in case I don't. I mean, this summer has been a real trip. That was 26 years ago, going on 27 now. And I had to have a lot of that surgery rebuilt this summer. And it's only because of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and being sober and having family back in my life and friends in my life in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that I was able to do that and able to be here tonight. And the surgery, as you can see, is pretty well recovered. And without Alcoholics Anonymous, that never would have been possible. It never would have been possible. But I got back to Little Rock, had more surgery, and obviously, I was able to walk, and I was able to get around. 14 months before I took my last drink of alcohol, because of an alcohol toxicity, I threw a grand mal seizure, fell off of a stool onto a concrete floor, broke, dislocated my right shoulder, broke my back in two places, and came out of it in traction in St. Vincent's Infirmary. It was not a problem to me. It was not a problem to me. And the little guy wound up being my sponsor. See, I'm the kind of guy where they were having meetings about me where I was the main topic of conversation. I wasn't invited to the meeting. And the topic was, well, what are we going to do with it? You know, I got here, I called myself a high bottom drunk. I had three people still talking to me. I know a lot of people got here and they didn't have anybody talking to me, not with me, to me. And one of them was a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous that literally saved my life. And they asked him, one of my colleagues knew that Lee used to drink. And he was bad to drink, and something happened a few years ago, and he went to these meetings at night, and he didn't drink anymore. And that's about all he knew, and he asked Lee what to do with me, and he says, you make sure he knows help's available, and then you leave him alone. And the words he said then are as true today as they were when they were written in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, except in different words. He said, every practicing drunk's got three choices. He's either going to get locked up, covered up, or sober up, period. And say, I'm the kind of guy, I wanted one more choice. There had to be one more out there. And they did the best they could, and I kept slipping the noose on them. The only problem I had when I was in St. Vincent's, you know, I was, by this point in time in my life, I was a problem to most of the Western Hemisphere, but it wasn't a problem to me. And I firmly believe that until it becomes a problem for me, I'm not going to do anything about it. And I think every practicing alcoholic out there is the same way. That until his drinking becomes a problem for him, he ain't going to do anything about it. The only problem I had is how to get out of St. Vincent's, go catty-corner across the street to Park Place with the liquor store that was there, and get a bottle of whiskey, go home. I live 15 minutes from from St. Vincent's, and I couldn't wait that long. When they finally did release me, I had to stop and have a bottle before I got home to my stash at home. That was 14 months before I took my last drink of alcohol. One of the things they told me when I was growing up was, get an education and be somebody. And what I heard them say was, you don't have an education, and therefore you're nobody. And see, that explained to me. That explained to me why I felt like nobody and why I felt like nothing. They said, you get an education, be somebody, and live in a big house in the hill and drive a white Cadillac, and you'll be happy. And what I heard them say was, we don't live in a big house in the hill, we don't drive a white Cadillac, and that's why you're not happy. And explain to me why I wasn't happy. 2 months before I took my last drink of alcohol, I lived in a big house in the hill and drove a white Cadillac, had more money in my pocket than I ever thought about having in sobriety. Most of it wasn't mine, but I had it. And my life was worse than it had ever been. Because by this time, alcohol had did that removal bit, and it had removed everything from me. It had removed family and friends and self-respect and jobs and employees and cars and relationships. And, you know, I was bad to lose a car. There is still a 56 Chevrolet sitting over in Oklahoma somewhere. I assume it's still in Oklahoma. I could have crossed state line with it for all I know. That was a routine deal, you know, get up in the morning, find my car. It removed things from me. And my drinking had been reduced down to one room. Kind of the way it was those last 3 or 4 or 5 weeks of drinking before I got sober was 5 o'clock in the evening, I'd get off work and I'd get a bottle of Wild Turkey and I'd drink until I passed out. And I'd stay passed out for a little while and I'd come to and I'd drink till I passed out. And I'd stay passed out for a little while and I'd come to and I'd drink till I passed out. And I'd come to about 5 o'clock in the morning. About 5 o'clock in the morning, I'd stick that thing in my arm and I'd stop the shakes and the sweats and the nausea. And I'd get up and I'd go to work. And 1 hour at a time, I'd stick that thing in my arm, and I'd stop the shakes and the sweats and the nausea until 5 o'clock in the evening, and I'd get that bottle of Wild Turkey. And I'd drink till I passed out, and I'd stay passed out for a while, and I'd come to, and I'd drink till I passed out. And I'd stay passed out for a while, and I'd come to about 5 o'clock in the morning, and I'd stick that thing in my arm, and I'd stop the shakes and the sweats and the nausea. And I did that 1 day at a time, 1 hour at a time. Until the end finally came. The last 3 or 4 days, it gets real fuzzy in there. The last 3 or 4 days of my drinking were spent on the floor where I couldn't get up, I couldn't get down, I couldn't live, and I couldn't die. And my magic wasn't magic anymore, and it wasn't taking me from over here to almost. It wasn't working anymore. I couldn't get up, and I couldn't live, and I couldn't die, and I couldn't go to sleep, and I couldn't wake up. And it wasn't working. I'm not the kind of guy that quits something I can still do. I didn't quit alcohol. Alcohol quit me. I'm the kind of guy, if it still worked for me, I'd still be out there doing it. But it doesn't work for me anymore. God looked down my life one more time, and he saw I wasn't going to get to where was I supposed to be when I was supposed to be there, and that I was one of those individuals that was totally incapable of reaching out for help. And I remember it like it was yesterday, and the phone rang, and it was one of those three people. And I remember saying, I'm in trouble. Boy, that's what they were waiting on. They must have been sitting up at the corner. You know, it didn't take them 3 minutes, it didn't seem like, to get to that house. And they came in like the stormtroopers, you know. You see the special forces come in. And they came in and captured me. And that was January 23rd of 1980, and I hadn't had a drink since. I did not know that was going to be my last drink up and through today. If I'd have known that was going to be my last drink up and through today, I'd have had at least one more, just in case, you know. But I had no idea it was going to be my last drink. And they came and got me, and they wouldn't let me stay by myself. They made me stay with one of them. Next morning, they took me down to see this little guy. And we were talking about this earlier today, that even I would have to admit it was my peer. He was a little doctor, lived south of Little Rock there, and they'd been talking to him about me. And he was sober almost exactly 2 years in the program by Alcoholics Anonymous. We went down there, and he started talking to me about the places I'd been, the things I'd done, the people I'd hurt, the cars I'd wrecked, and all this kind of stuff. We were there for hours. You know, and people are stacking up in his reception area, and all of a sudden it dawned on me he wasn't talking about me. He was talking about him. I never knew there was another human being on the face of the earth that felt the way I felt and done the things I'd done. I did kind of envy him, though, because he did one thing that I wish I'd done. Everything else I did that he did. But he took a .357 Magnum and tried to shoot the ducks on the country club pond. And I didn't belong to the country club. I'm not sure he did, but he didn't hit any, but he tried. And I thought, boy, that would have been fun. You know? At night, he put his hand on my shoulder and he says, "Everything gonna be all right." And I thought, heck it is. It's not all right right now. It wasn't all right yesterday. And I see no reason to think it's gonna be all right tomorrow. I don't know about y'all, but there are some things we tell newcomers to program Alcoholics Anonymous I think we need to be real careful about. One of the things we tell newcomers is no major decisions for a full year. That sounds real good. A, that's not conference-approved material. B, there's a step up there real close to the top that says, made a decision to turn our life and will over the care of God. Are we going to wait a year to take steps? I don't know about y'all, but they made me start making decisions right off the bat. And one of the decisions they made me make, and why all that other, those outside issues are important in my life, is he told me, he said, "We can take you up to Baptist Hospital and they'll dry you out and stand you on your feet, and then you're going to get to answer a whole bunch of questions about those outside issues." And see, the problem with that in my life is that legally, ethically, morally, I have the right and the privilege to write a script for your dog for just about anything on the market. There's a lot of non-existent dogs in Little Rock and North Little Rock and Jacksonville and Cabot and Lone Oak and Benton that took a lot of Hicodan and Percodan and Codeine, Morphine, Demerol, and Tylenol, all that crap, and I didn't want to answer those questions because I knew what they did with guys like me, and I was too pretty. He said there was another way, and everything going to be all right. There won't be any questions. Boy, that sounded like a good idea to me. No questions. I had no idea he was talking about AA. The only AA I ever heard of was American Airlines and Ancient Age. You know, I like to fly both of them, preferably at the same time. They took me to this jitter joint. In some circles, they call them treatment centers. By the way, treatment centers do not turn out winners. Treatment centers, if treatment centers worked and turned out winners, AA would be out of business. Treatment centers do two major things. They do some other minor things. In my case, one of the minor things was they detoxed me, and naturally they let me shake it out cold. They didn't give me any Valium. They let me feel all of it, and they took me off the street and protected me from the world, protected me from myself. But treatment centers do two things. They teach me what the problem is and where the solution is. Problem is I can't successfully drink alcohol. Solution is in Alcoholics Anonymous. Get your butt in there, you're going to die. Pretty simple. That's $30,000 worth of information, folks. Or whatever it is Betty Ford and Hazel and all them charge, you know. If treatment centers turned out winners, all any of us would have to do is get $30,000 or $40,000 together, go check in Betty Ford, stay 36 days, whatever it is, come out and drink and be, you know, be wonderful. And drink no more. Problem is I can't successfully drink alcohol. Problem is solutions in Alcoholics Anonymous, get your butt in AA, you're gonna die. And fortunately I wound up in a good jitter joint. And another thing I tell the newcomers today, in the way of sponsors, is they say, find somebody who has what you want. God, I'm glad they didn't tell me that. The one who had what I wanted was about 5'2", blonde, drove a Mercedes convertible. And she was just darling. The one I got was about 5'6", 200 pounds, uneducated, talked incessantly about himself. And thank God for him. Thank God for him because he saved my life. They signed sponsors. You know, he came up. I'll tell you what really happened was they drew straws, and he got the short one. He came up and he said, by the way, I'm your sponsor. Okay. Yeah, I didn't have a clue. He started giving me things to do, and I didn't want to do them. Y'all may find it a little hard to believe, but I was a little mouthy when I got sober, and he'd tell me to do so-and-so, and I'd ask him why. Why I got to do that? And finally, he had about all me he could stand one day, and he says, boy, your doctors are son, sponsors are boy. You know, sponsor calls you boy, you know you're in trouble. And he says, boy, why is a three-letter word? Surely as smart, as intelligent as you are, you can get along the rest of your life without asking why. You know what happens in my life? When I go without asking why, my life gets so good I have to ask why. Invariably I'll do that. They ask people, newcomers, they ask me that famous, stupid question, do you want what we have? I didn't know what it was y'all had, and I told you so. And then you follow it up. You know, we follow it up and we say, do you, you willing to go to any lengths? And I told him no. And finally, he got it down simple for me. Y'all didn't have a lot to work with when I got here. He said, you want what you have. Well, I understood that. You know, I didn't know what it was he had, but I knew I didn't want any more of what I had. And so we began to do these things. And people today just amaze me. They say, I have to call my sponsor every day. Well, big deal. I'd call mine 3 times a day. I'd call him 6 o'clock every morning. He'd tell me to go to work like I didn't know to go to work. You know, I'd get off at 5 o'clock in the evening. He'd tell me what meeting I was going to, like I couldn't decide what meeting to go to on my own after all. But you know who I am. And we didn't do 90 meetings in 90 days. That's not conference approved material. That's not a big book. We lived one day at a time. We went to meetings one day at a time. We went to a hell of a lot more than 90 meetings in 90 days, but we did it one day at a time. 10 o'clock at night, I'd call and report in like the little child. One day he asked me, he said, what'd they talk about? I didn't know. I just went to his meetings. I didn't know you were supposed to pay attention. I didn't know I was there to save my life. And so I had to start carrying a little notebook in the car, not in the meeting, and write down one thing that I might have heard that night that might help me go another day without taking a drink. I'd call him at night and bounce it off of him. I'd been sober a few years, and I found that little old dippy notebook. That is some of the sickest stuff I have ever seen in my life. I know y'all didn't say that stuff. I know today why he had me call at 10 o'clock at night and go over it, in order for him to straighten out what it was I heard. I heard stuff y'all never even thought about saying, much less said. It was awful. He told me things like, make your bed. Scared me to death. I didn't know how he knew my bed wasn't made. And he knew everybody in Alcoholics Anonymous, seemed like. Everywhere we went, he knew them. So I started making my bed. Margaret and I had been married a couple of years. First 2 years we were married. She was scared to death to get out of the bed and go to the bathroom at night, afraid I'd make a bed. Just Well, you don't know. I didn't know. He said things like, be grateful. Be grateful. I'm grateful for nothing. I ain't grateful for you. I ain't grateful for AA. I'm not one of these y'all that came into Alcoholics Anonymous. In case you hadn't picked up on this yet, I did not come in here and find my people. It was not wonderful from the day I walked in the doors of Alcoholics. I came in here and you all were awful. I didn't have a resentment until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. Got in here and you was hugging and kissing and laughing and carrying on. There wasn't nothing funny in my life. Hadn't been a long time. He said, be grateful. Be grateful. So one night, I'd gone up to this group, and it was a closed speaker meeting. And I listened to the speaker call that night, reporting in. I said, I'm grateful. Ah, God, I am just so grateful. He said, fantastic. Tell me about it. Well, I heard this. Tell me about why you're grateful. Well, this is a closed speaker meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. By the way, y'all, this meeting is no longer in existence. If you can't figure out from this story why it's no longer in existence, I'm going to refer you to the 12 steps, 12 tradition, and 12 concepts of Alcoholics Anonymous. But it's no longer in existence. It was a closed meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous where they had an Al-Anon speaker. Now, at the closed meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous where they had the Al-Anon speaker, the Al-Anons were meeting off up the hall, but they wouldn't let the Al-Anons come hear the Al-Anon at the closed AA meeting because it was a closed AA meeting where the Al-Anons were speaking. The meeting is no longer in existence. He said, I told him I went to that meeting, heard her story and all that stuff. He said, well, great, but why are you sober? He said, I told him, well, you know, I'm the marrying kind, and I am just so grateful. I didn't stay out there any longer than I did because I know, sure as world, I'd have wound up with one like her, and I am so grateful I didn't. And she, and after her, she and I are good friends. And we laugh about that today. Is, you know, no human power can keep us sober, but I guarantee you fear of getting one like her kept me sober for a while. And that talk this morning reminded me of that. I'm still grateful. Thank you. I love Al-Anon dearly, but I'm so grateful I didn't get one like that old gal. Damn it. My life continued, and Christmas. If that's right, I've got to get sober here pretty quick. Milton said I could talk as long as it took me to get here. We were 9 hours on the road, so yeah, everybody get comfortable. I'd go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and I'd sit back. I'd slip in that door. And this is a wonderful meeting room because I could slip in that door right back there at 1 minute to late, sit on that back row. 1 minute after 9, I'd be gone. You'd never see me. And I'd been to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't sit on the back row anymore. You know, I sit up front where I can hear. He caught me and he took me down in front and asked Frank W. to move. And let me, you know, those who don't know who Frank is, Frank's been sober forever. And said, would you ask him, would you move over so this sick so-and-so can sit here and maybe hear something he can stay sober with? And Frank did. And this was in front of 150 people. when I first got sober, there was a lot of not drinking, just not drinking in my life. It was go to work and not drink, go home and not drink, and go to meetings and not drink, go home and not drink, go to work and not drink. There was a lot of just hanging in there, not drinking. And see, when they drank like I did, I was a daily, hourly drinker. I had to have it around the clock. My sponsor said, all I expect from you is to put in as much time and effort getting sober as you did, either thinking about a drink, taking a drink, or getting over a drink. I said, well, I didn't leave me any time. He said, all I expect from you is the same amount of time you put in taking a drink, getting over a drink, or thinking about taking it. He didn't care. Those that are in need tonight, I'm going to make you some of the promises that he made me. He promised me, he guaranteed me, he said, you never, ever, ever have to take another drink of alcohol as long as you live unless you yourself choose to do so. I told him I didn't think it wouldn't work. He said, I don't care. He said, you never, ever have to go back to living hell that you put yourself in unless you yourself choose to do so. And I said, it ain't going to work. He said, I don't care. Take action and see who gets the result. And for you, those of you who are new tonight, or relatively new, I'll make you the same guarantee. You never, ever have to take another drink of alcohol unless you yourself choose to do so. And you never, ever have to go back to that living hell that you put yourself in unless you yourself choose to do so. It doesn't matter what I think about something. See, it's not what I think about something that matters. It's the action I'm taking against the thinking I'm thinking, because it's a result. Somewhere in this room, there is a light switch. And it doesn't matter whether I think it'll work or not. It's the action that I take. If I walk in here and it's dark and I don't think that light switch will work, and I throw that switch and the light comes on, it doesn't matter what I think. If I don't think that light switch will work and I don't take the action, I don't get the miracle. I can't become a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous by going to meetings. We talk about go to meetings. Go to meetings is part of it. But it's just like a chicken. You know, I can't be a chicken anymore by going sitting in a hen house. Then I can become a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous by just going and sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I gotta go sit in a hen house and lay an egg. I got to go sit in the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and turn out some work and work some steps until they become a way of life. One morning I was driving to work, and I looked up and, you know, drinking had been a big thing in my life, and it's on my mind constantly in early sobriety. And I looked up and I saw a billboard for Jack Daniel's Black Label. And I looked at that and I thought, you know, I can't remember the last time I actively thought about taking a drink. And I tried to remember the last time and I couldn't remember. And I got to work and I called him second time that morning. It's only 7 o'clock. And I'm calling him second time. And I said, I don't remember the last time I actively thought about taking a drink. And he started laughing. He says, you know what's happened? He said, the obsession to take a drink's been removed. And I said, nah. He said, yeah. And guess what? If you continue to do the things you're doing on a daily basis, it'll never return. I said, I don't believe you. He said, I don't care. You know, I found out about sponsors. I know a lot of y'all already know this because you've been around long enough to know this. But for those of you who don't know, you know, sponsors say they care, but they really don't care. The only time they ever care is when you're doing just exactly what it is they want you to do the way they want you to do it. Otherwise, they don't care. You know what? Up and through today, the obsession to take a drink has never returned. It, no matter what I believe, it doesn't matter. I'd go to those meetings and I'd get out at 1 minute after nine. I wouldn't say anything to anybody. And one night they ganged up on me. And they said, how you doing? They trapped me is what they did. You know, we'll let a newcomer slide for a while. And this room be perfect to catch somebody in. there's a little four-year thing back there. You could catch somebody good. And they said, how you doing? I'm fine. I'm just fine. And I'm about to die and I'm about to break into 10,000 tiny crystal pieces on the floor and I'm just fine. And I'm hanging on. The people in Alcoholics Anonymous loved me with that unconditional love. They didn't want anything from me. They didn't expect anything from me. All they wanted from me was whatever it was I wanted from me. And if I wanted to get sober, great, they'd walk the walk with me. They wouldn't walk it for me, but they'd walk it with me. And if I wanted to go out and drink, that was fine too. What they just wanted from me, whatever it was I wanted from me. And I began to let them walk the walk with me a little bit. And they loved me unconditionally long enough for me to begin to receive their love a little bit, long enough for me to start caring about myself a little bit, long enough for me to start caring about them. And I didn't mean for that to happen. There's been so much happened to me in the program by Alcoholics Anonymous. Today, when people ask, how you doing? If I'm not too tired and I think they really want to know, I'll tell them how I'm doing today. Today, I'm the best I ever been. I'm the best Robert Barris I've ever been. I've got the best relationship with God that I ever could have imagined. God's not who I thought he was or what I thought he was. See, the God of my understanding today has a sense of humor. If you don't think the God of your understanding has a sense of humor, look around at some of the people God has put in your life. Yeah, God loves me and he wants me to be happy. God gives me today everything it is I need to get through today. Today, I'm the kind of guy that I want today everything it is that I need to get through tomorrow today. But God won't give me today's stuff or tomorrow's stuff today. He only gives me today's stuff today. I found out that it's not necessary for me to understand God. It's only necessary that I understand that God understand me. See, if I understood God, he'd be way too small to do the things in my life that are necessary to do. I've got the best relationship with other people that I ever could have imagined. I don't have to be to you whatever it is I think you think I ought to be. It's probably wrong anyway because I thought it. And you're here, so your thinker's not all that great either. there is so much I want to say. I've got the best relationship with myself that I ever could have imagined. I'm not who I thought I was or what I thought I was. I'm a child of God. I've got the right to be right, and I've got the right to be wrong. I've got the right to hurt. I've got the right to feel feelings. Found out about feelings. Feeling. God, don't you love going to a meeting on feelings? Gee, make me gag. Feelings just are. They're not good. They're not bad. They just are. You know, they're part of being a human being. See, today, I don't have problems in my life today. Today, I just have situations. And you all have given me the tools to get through those situations and come out on the other side stronger and better if I choose to pick them up. What I found out about life is one adjustment after another stinking adjustment all day long. I'm the kind of guy who my adjustment screw is, the threads are stripped. You know, and I get everything set just about like they need to be, and all y'all are acting right, and then my adjustment screw falls out, and I'm back at point A, you know. And today I've learned how to live life on life's terms. I never was able to do that before. I don't have to cope today. Thank God I don't have to cope today. Today I live life on life's terms. Things just happen. Bad things don't happen. Just things happen. Today, I'm fortunate enough to have the tools that when things happen and I get on the other side of it, sometimes I'm able to look back and see what it was that was really happening because I didn't know what it was that was happening when it was happening. So today, when people ask, how you doing? If I think they really want to know, I'll tell them. I'm the best Robert Barris I've ever been, and the only difference today in my life between being the very best I've ever been and laying on the floor and not being able to get up and not being able to get down and not being able to live and not being able to die, the only difference in my life today is programmed by Alcoholics Anonymous. Being with you people, I'm a better person than I'm capable of being by myself. I am not capable of doing this by myself, and it's only by being around y'all. Real quick, boy, it's got to be quick. I love the opening statement about looking for romance in AA. Odds are good, and goods are odd. Well, start dated in AA. There's an experience for you. You take them home and you don't really try to put the make on them or hold hands and say the Lord's Prayer. You talk about mixed signals. I love you. Okay, what does that mean? You know, I know what it used to mean. Old Margaret and I hooked it up 22 years ago. I used to say it was my current wife to keep her on her toes. One day I heard her tell one of her prospects, my current husband, and I thought, wait a minute. But we've got a good deal going. You know, we've been at it now 22 years, and that may not, that's no doubt not much for y'all, a lot of y'all. That's a miracle for me. That's more than all the rest of them put together, multiplied by several digits. And I've got more than three. We got a stack of divorce papers this high, y'all. Yeah. God, you hate to throw it out. But she had three boys. And the oldest one, I'm not breaking any anonymities here. Three boys, three alcoholics. And I thought I knew what I was getting married, doing when we got married. Because, see, the youngest one was about 19 years old. I figured he was about half housebroken. Wrong. He wasn't. The two oldest ones were in the military. They were gone. And let me tell you, being with them gone, it's a lot easier than them being home. But the oldest one and I today, we have a pretty good relationship. You know, he and I get along pretty well. And I understand him, and he understands me. And he's not in AA, but he's not drinking. He's got a little higher power, but yeah, he's so tall. She explains it to him. You know, gives him all the information he needs. And he's given Margaret a couple of grandchildren. Like I said, I know absolutely nothing about children. I'm not all that interested in learning, particularly. But what is fun is to watch her with those grandchildren. She just has a big time with them, and that gives me a lot of pleasure. And without Alcoholics Anonymous, that wouldn't have been possible. The youngest one was an alcoholic by his, or rather, the middle one. The middle one today is sober. He is genuinely sober in the Pulaski County Corrections Facility, and will be there for a little while. The youngest one, because of the disease of alcoholism, found it necessary to take his own life at 26 years of age. And I understand the pain, and he wasn't drinking. It was the pain of being sober. And I understand that kind of pain, because he didn't have a program to live by. I don't know where you are in steps today, but I had a lot of trouble with steps, especially step two. I could not believe. My sponsor told me, said, get over here and look at that step. Step says, came to believe. First 100 didn't believe either. He said they came to believe. You don't have to start by believing. You can just start by being suspicious, and that'll be enough to get you started. And I said, I can't do that. And he said, that's okay. You can start by hoping, and that'll be enough to get you started. And that's what happened. And I started by hoping, and that's enough to get me started. And so if you're here tonight and you're having trouble, you don't have to. You can just start by believing that I believe, and that'll be enough to get you started. Thank you very much.